Welcome back to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. I'm your host, Michael Colligan, and this is the other host, Gregory Eric. Hey, Greg.
Hey, thanks for introducing me.
On today's show, I got in trouble. A couple of people have been saying they don't know what my name is because I never introduced myself. You should all know my name by now out there, lighting world. But anyway, Michael Colligan's my name, and I'm with Chad Shapiro. He has had a fascination with lighting since the age of 13 when his interests in Thomas Edison shifted from the phonograph to the invention of the first successful incandescent lamp. Mentored by historic light bulb and Edisonia veterans like Dr. Hugh F. Hicks and later the late Charlie Hummel, Chad went on the search, went on a search, went on to search the world for the earliest examples of electric lighting history. Alongside this near lifetime fascination with electric lighting, Chad's father had been a lifelong electronics technician. Chad grew up installing electronic gadgets alongside his father for much of his childhood. After working for his father for about 10 years, Chad founded Sterling Sound and Vision in 2012 to focus on the luxury home automation market. As the home technology industry has long supported the use of lighting control systems, the progression to a specification of architectural lighting was a natural one, with a focus on LED lighting as a technology. Today, Chad works with lighting every day, both in his professional work as well as his hobby. As a strong proponent for educating clients on what the pitfalls of poorly designed LED-based lighting systems, on the pitfalls. Chad helps his clients achieve results often found to be difficult when implementing LED lighting in the luxury market for both aesthetic and comfort aspects. But before we get too comfortable with Chad, Greg, we got to keep it easy, buddy. We got to go down to KeystoneTech.com. That's KeystoneTech.com. Light made easy.
And you can be comfortable with those guys because you know why we're going to talk a little today about history. They have history. 1945 is when they started. That's almost 80 years ago now, if I do the math right. Almost, maybe like 78, something like that. But long history. Started as a ballast company, now I've become one of the leaders in the lighting industry and family owned too. Like we know the people that own this place. There's a lot of lighting companies now that don't have that. There's nobody behind the scenes. It's some accountant running the show that doesn't care about lighting. Keystone cares. They have history. That's important to make lighting what it is now. So thank you, Keystone.
And I like to keep it easy. KeystoneTech.com. Of course, they're members of the greatest association in the world, and that's the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. Go to NAILD.org. If you got light bulbs in a warehouse and you sell them over a counter, on a website, over the phone, then you got to go to nail.org, NAILD.org. Chad, welcome to the Get a Grip on Lighting podcast. Someone forgot to turn off his phone. What an amateur move. Sorry about that. Hey, Chad, how are
Thank
you?
you. Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm well, thank you.
Greg, you started off here.
Yeah, so you read your bio, but a lighting you're a lighting historian, is that right?
Yeah, so I started researching the work of Edison as early as 8 or 9 years old, and first started collecting what was accessible to me, which is phonographs, record players. And ultimately, by about the age of 13, I discovered on a new website on the internet called eBay, an Edison light bulb, which can mean a lot of things. And instantly, I told my father, "I have to have this." And he said, "Well, how much is it?" And I said, "Well, it's at $200. $200 for a light bulb." Needless to say, that wasn't going to happen. But he remembered as a kid reading about a dentist in Baltimore who had an antique light bulb collection in a private museum. And we looked him up. That was Dr. Hicks, and he became my first mentor in the field.
Wow. So how do you go about then collecting the information you do? eBay was one source. You met him, but where do you get to your information from to compile it then to make it understandable for where everything came from?
Well, what's interesting is for decades, what I'll call the first generation of light bulb collectors had very little information to work off of. There were books written by people who were involved in the electric lighting industry very early on, but they're books written 50 years later. I remember things differently than notes actually show from 20 years ago. Imagine 50 years later, writing your recollections. So much of the information that was passed around, and in some cases still used in exhibits in museums, turned out to be incorrect. The reality was the information was always there. It just wasn't accessible. The internet brought about a huge change. It brought about book dealers putting all of their wares on the internet available to buy. So period trade journals, early historic books could be found and purchased. And then universities have begun scanning and uploading to Google Books thousands and thousands of pages of period trade journals and other reports on the period. So through that, I've been able to piece together the history better than really I think it's ever been done before. But that said, it's something I'll do for the rest of my life and never finish.
So what is your plan with it then, or how are you presenting it to people so they can read it? I know maybe in the bio it said it, or maybe there's a link you're going to talk about, but how do we find this info?
At this point, there is no compiled location or a book or anything like that. Much of my collection, some of which is now online, will display some bits and pieces, but would require, you know, a little bit more knowledge of the history to actually be able to piece that together. So it's really something that I'd love to compile a catalog resume of historic light bulbs and related equipment from the period. I think that's something one does in retirement. Running a full-time business, time for something like that is very dear. So,
what's your oldest lighting item that you own?
So the earliest lighting item would not be incandescent lighting; it would be arc lighting. So arc lighting goes back to as early as 1806, when Humphrey Davy in England took two carbon rods, touched them together, that were connected to a battery of cells, pulled them apart, and an arc was formed. And it was very, very white, bluish, harsh light, but it actually emitted an electric light. From there, starting in the 1840s and 50s, in Europe, arc lights were made. They were generally used for anything from a demonstration for a physics class to lighting magic lanterns, which were early slide projectors. Very few were used for actual commercial lighting. In 1856, the first arc lamp was used in England, though, to light a lighthouse. So arc lamps, European arc lamps from the 1850s and 60s would be the earliest. And incandescent lighting, which is my true focus and what most people these days understand, would be an Edison prototype from about March of 1880.
Do you have any of these arc lights, arc lighting devices?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Do they work?
Yeah, some do. Some do. Some are way too historically important and rare to attempt to use them. Things can go wrong. But I do have an example or two that I have used to illuminate and light up, and they do work. It's a terrible product. Nobody would actually want one for actual use. Thus, the challenge Edison faced in finding something that would be so much better.
And as far as incandescents go, what's your oldest one there? Is it just a standard shape or anything unique to it?
I know that would be an Edison prototype from about March of 1880. So Edison's first successful filament was carbonized cotton thread, and that's about October 22nd of 1879. This all moves very, very quickly. Weeks prior, Edison was still set on using platinum as a filament, based on the concept that it had a very high melting rate, but still wasn't high enough melting rate to withstand the heat of incandescence. So by December of 1879, Edison is now stamping paper, they called it Bristol board, kind of like a manila envelope type material, into a horseshoe shape, carbonizing that, so heating it to a point where it's replaced by carbon, installing that in the light bulb, and has success with having a demonstration on New Year's Eve of 1879 with the lamp. So the lamp, the earliest piece I have, used as a paper filament, it has some attributes from a little bit later research, which brings us to about March of 1880.
And where do you keep all your stuff? Just right behind you there?
I'm sorry?
Is it right behind you? Is that what we're talking?
Oh, there's some great stuff behind me, but there are thousands of pieces in the collection. Something like early Edison prototype light bulbs are kept in a 4-hour fireproof rated safe. It's an irreplaceable piece of electric lighting history. It's one of the earliest surviving light bulbs in the world, and I sleep better at night knowing that it's very well protected. Others are in display cases. Others are in museum-type storage cabinets with drawers that pull out, making them very accessible to study and look at. But when it comes to something that's just incredibly important and irreplaceable, it stays in a little more secure environment.
Have you ever heard of a guy named Nicholas Nassim Taleb? You ever heard of that guy?
I have not.
He wrote a bunch of books. One of them is called The Black Swan. And one of his books was called Anti-Fragile. And what the book was about was the persistence of older technology outlasting newer technology. So according to his theory, the light switch will far outlast any digital systems. The digital systems will come and go, but the light switch will stay the same because it has inherent usefulness. What do you think of the incandescent light bulb? We have all these light bulb bands. We have all these different things. Like, this thing's had a run. 150-year run, this technology.
Yeah.
You know,
it's number
been pretty,
one.
Pretty persistent. Yeah.
I'm sorry. Like, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, my question is really: do you see a future for it, or are we looking at all of these lamps becoming museum pieces now?
Oh, first off, though you didn't ask, I think if Edison were alive today, he would be excited about advancement of technology and lighting, and not have any stronghold on his incandescent filament lamp. Number two, I think you mentioned the bands. I think they're foolish. I'm sure you guys can relate lighting people when you walk into a room that you haven't been in before, whether it's somebody's home, a museum, a restaurant. We look up, right? We're looking at how they lit the room, whether they did a poor job or an excellent job, to see how they did it or where they screwed up. I don't look up and see a lot of incandescent lamps anymore. There's a current trend in what people call Edison style light bulbs that have a nostalgic look. Sure, the nicer ones, the better looking ones are incandescent. But the ban is banning something that the market, I think, from what I see, the market cares so little about. The majority of people in home and business have converted to LED for better or for worse. I'm fortunate enough to deal with a clientele who can afford for us to spec, very good LED products that deal with circadian rhythm and high CRI and all the things that your hardware store, big box store shelf don't deliver on very well, or don't deliver at all. Regardless, people are switching over to LED. They want to lower their energy costs. They want to lower the maintenance of changing out light bulbs. So I think the government banned something that wasn't a problem, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree with you.
As far as longevity, I'll be the first to admit I'm not a lighting LED design technology, but I'd like to see the LED that you can put in your oven for an oven light.
Yeah, it'd be good to see.
So maybe it comes to some sort of fiber optic or something like that that allows the luminaire to be remotely located and not melt. I don't know. I think there are certainly people who have a stronghold who are unwilling to move forward. I did listen to one of your podcasts from a gentleman who felt LED was downright dangerous. I'm open to listening of those claims. I personally don't feel as though my life has been damaged by living in quality LED lighting.
But you can't prove that it hasn't been.
Oh,
right?
True.
Like that's always our, it seems like we make decisions in our society by forming a straw man in our argument and then asking everybody to refute it without offering proof of our own particular position. That's certainly true with light and safety as vis-a-vis outdoor lighting. There's no proof that electric light delivers more safety. There are elements of security in it and this and that, but, does it do this or that? Nobody really knows, but that's the assumption. And if you want to move in that direction, you have to prove that straw man wrong, rather than him having to prove that he's right. LED finds itself in that position right now where there's certainly some things that are causing suspicion, but the onus is not on LED manufacturers or suppliers or anything to prove that their lights are healthy. The onus is on the people that are trying to prove that they're unhealthy. And maybe that's correct, maybe it isn't, who knows. You know, I think, you know, one of the things I've said, Chad, for a long time is that it would be nice to have lighting that didn't cause damage to people rather than try to make lights that actually improve people's health. One thing we do know, though, Chad, is that incandescent lights certainly deliver a lot of IR energy, infrared.
Mm-hmm.
And right. People are talking about putting tiny little incandescent filaments into LED lights in order to deliver some infrared. I don't know if you've encountered this in your practice yet.
I haven't. That's very interesting, though. If you look behind me, the goal is to eliminate infrared for the protection of these artifacts that have any type of, you know, wood mm-hmm. components and printed components that are sensitive to UV. So in most cases, my fascination with museum lighting, which isn't the field I'm in at this time, is, you know, LED is a very welcome mm-hmm. aspect due to its lack of UV radiance. So that is interesting as far as looking to add UV and based on the fact that, you know, as our bodies are tuned and built to be exposed to it. So that makes sense.
Yeah. And so if we're looking at mimicking the sun, I would argue that halogen is probably the closest light source we have to sunlight. An LED can't even come close to that.
Well, so I have this conversation a lot with my clients. First off, I think a lot of outside of the technical and you know, possibly based medical claims, I think on the internet there is a large swath of people that just insist on nostalgia and keeping a technology for technology state. And I think they've also justified it by being exposed to bad LED product, which is, I don't know how to quantify this because, again, in the world that I'm fortunate to work in, we get to work with really nice product. The majority of what's out there, though, is junk that you buy off of the big box store. And one of the
or at Premier Lighting, you can buy that junk at Premier Lighting too.
No, sir.
Sorry. Go ahead.
One of the conversations we have all the time is, ironically, as you said, is starting with the sun. And the fact that the sun is the only true light source that we as humans know, right? Other than, I guess, fire. But you take an object, we use an example of a red apple outside in the sun, and you look at that red apple and the sun's rays hit that apple, reflect off of it, and are received by your eyes and your brain processes that is red. That's the true red, as you know it, based on you know, the limitations of your eyesight per individual. Being that incandescent in many ways creates light the same way through heat, they also have 100 CRI rating generally. So halogen worked great. You in high-end homes, MR16s were the thing to use, right? And although those vary drastically in color, I'm sure you've gone to a site where MR16s after years, the reflective coating on the back is shifted and they're putting out green or blue light. So they're not exactly trouble free, but I have found, you know, when you buy used to be GE Constant Color, they're discontinued. Ushio out of Japan, I think some of them are made in Germany, makes excellent MR16s. So yeah, those were great. And people built beautiful homes. They spent a lot of money with architects, interior designers, creating these luxurious surfaces and spaces. And halogen did a great job of illuminating it. If you were to go to Home Depot and buy cheap LED MR16s and replace those in one of those houses, it's going to change. It's not going to look as good. It's not going to have the right feel. I think as we reach higher TM30 and CRI ratings, I think we get better and better color accuracy. And I think as we institute worm dimming technology, where we have two different color chips within a luminaire to shift between, say, 3000 down to 1800 Kelvin, I think we eliminate a lot of issues. the lack of infrared and all. I'm not a medical professional. I really don't have any experience in that, and I don't read much about it. And maybe I should. However, I think we've gotten to a point with the proper product. Now you're talking about, you're not comparing a $20 high-end, constant color Ushio MR16 in a Juno can that's, $120. You're talking about a fixture that's $300 to $700, right? This isn't for everybody. But with that type of product, we deliver a really nice LED experience for our client that very much mimics the sun. And one further point is, humans adapt very quickly, for better or for worse, to changes around them. I relate this back to when plasma TVs were replaced by LCD TVs. Plasma TVs had gorgeous color. They had great color depth, great contrast. The picture was incredible. The market came out and said, you don't want your plasma anymore. They're bulky, they're energy consuming, and you need an LCD TV. And everybody threw out their plasma TVs and bought LCD TVs and go, oh, great. Guess what? There was no comparison. The LCD TVs didn't look anywhere near as good. So people take out their incandescent light bulbs in their house, screw in their big box hardware store LED bulbs of whatever they wind up buying, because they're basing it on soft, whiter daylight, so it's dumbed down for the average consumer, and don't seem to notice it. We had one client who remodeled their house, and we replaced everything, spec'd everything as a very nice high-end LED luminaire with high CRI and worm dimming technology. And when it was all done, the client said to me, you have changed how we live in this house. Well, I smiled and thanked her and told her how happy I am. But the reality is I gave her back something she had 10 years ago. She just forgot and adjusted for some reason to something that was inferior.
Hmm. Well, Greg, before you jump on, I'm just going to, maybe this is a confession. I don't know. But actually, I don't know what's good light and which isn't. I've done over 1,000 podcasts now, Restoring Darkness, Light Ted, Get a Grip on Lighting. And I listen to people, and I'm skeptical about everything that comes out new. And, this idea that this is cheap and that's good. We've talked about this before, Greg. That I don't think anybody really knows. I don't think the technology's been around long enough. And, I just listened to a podcast the other day where the guy was talking about how the sun is conscious. It has its own consciousness. And I was listening to that and I was thinking, I wonder if the language of the sun is light. And that's how it sends information to Earth to revolve around it. And that's how it to grow stuff or whatever. And they were having this conversation. And so this idea that one can mimic daylight, that's like a hallucination or a trick or something. Even this idea of using two chips, Greg, and warming between the two, that's like tricking people. It's not actually warming or whatever. It's like mixing it so that the human with their eyes thinks that it's similar to the sun setting. I mean, I got these fake skylights here in the producer's office, Chad. And I'll tell you, man, when you're standing outside that office and you look into the producer's office, you damn well think there is a skylight in there. It looks like daylight, man. These things are incredible.
Yeah.
Okay. It's having a health impact on the producer for sure. If that is, he's going like this. Yes. He loves it. And so that mimicking of it, there's definitely an element if you get it right, like we have what they had with these skylights here, fake skylights, that if people think it is sunlight, there's an element of health benefit there. Even if it's missing something. And so I think that's what you're trying to address, Chad. And I think there's something that we need to know more about what sunlight is and what kind of information it's telling people. Like, why is it telling your skin to tan? And you know what I'm saying? Like, it tells your body to make your skin a darker tone. Like, how does it it does that with IR?
I think that's just large quantities of UV. When you lay in a tanning bed,
sure,
that's what's happening.
Yeah, but there's more to it than that. No, what I'm saying is that I don't think you totally understand what I'm saying. You're saying, well, it's only because there's large quantities of UV. You're missing the point that the species has evolved to react to that in that way, right?
Oh,
so
I agree.
The sunlight hits our skin. It doesn't burn us to ashes. Or our body literally says, oh, okay, sunlight, let's change the color of your skin a little bit here so you can be more and more out in the sun. And so this idea of mimicking sunlight is a, I think it's a bad idea for the lighting industry to try to suggest that we should do that.
Well, incandescent lighting didn't do that, right?
Yeah, well, so people are saying that they can create health. They're saying that they can create certain effects which affect people's circadian rhythms in a positive or negative way. And, you know, they have studies and stuff. I just don't know if that those studies are applicable in a general environment. Do you think you can help someone's circadian rhythm with LED lighting?
Maybe. So one thing, are we okay to say brand names?
I just keep it agnostic.
Yeah.
Okay. So one product line we use is a product that produces, you know, the capability of producing millions of colors. And besides the novelty of being able to do blue, green, purple, whatever, lighting out of the luminaire or lamp that's used, has the ability, along with a software package, to mimic the sun. I understand we're mimicking, we're not creating the sun, but mimic the sun. If you turn on the lights at 5 a.m., the lights are going to come on at a very, very warm tone, very, very soft in intensity. And if you leave them on as the day progresses and the software pays attention to your location, as the day progresses, it increases the color temperature or raises it, and raises the intensity as the day progresses, to mimic the sun, to at some point, say at 2 p.m., it's actually at 4,200 Kelvin, which is a little bit more invigorating for work. And then as the day progresses towards evening, it does the reverse. It gets softer and warmer. I don't think incandescent ever did anything like that. So I think trying to compare any artificial light source to the sun for use indoors isn't exactly a fair comparison, because the only true answer is to go outside, right, for that exposure. I don't think we've ever gotten that exposure indoors from candles, oil lamps, gas lighting, incandescent lamps, and now LED. However, there's no question that all of those prior light sources created light through heat, which is how the sun creates light. We've removed that element in LED, or lost it. Anything we can do to bring that back in, I think, improves the product and the technology. Now, the company that I just mentioned that makes that whole product, which is a luminaire or lamp and software package, moved very quickly away. Early on, they talked about health benefits and very quickly moved away from that and encouraged all their reps, all their dealers, specifiers, et cetera, to stop talking about that. Mostly because it's been challenged, and it may or may not be true. But regardless, if we can create within a home a better experience of living in your home based on the fact that our bodies are tuned for lighting to change in color, temperature, and intensity throughout the day, and you're able to afford this luxury product, and it's very expensive, it's a great thing. I think that the problem is that it's accessible to so few. So it's very easy to say, you know what, LED has a lot of shortfalls and it's not a very great product for my home. Most people aren't going to spend, you know, $1,000 for a light fixture.
The interesting part that I'm hearing you're saying, and from Mike and I's perspective, is different. You're selling to homes and we're residential. We're selling commercial. And where's the play with this going to be? Is it going to be both, or where does it make more sense? You know, I know there's one organization that is making a push for residential lighting coming up that they're talking about, you know, that circadian and making your home the right lighting. Do you make your home? Do you make your business? Where is it going to take off, or is it ever going to take off? To me, it seems like it would have to be at the business, but they're in the commercial side, but I don't know.
Right. Well, the residential side, it holds a very, very small portion of the market right now. It's the one percenters or less than that in many cases. And really, it's something that has to improve and quickly, just because we are people are forced now, if they noticed the difference between incandescent, if they had their lights on a dimmer, especially an LED, they deserve better. But like the example of the client who said we changed the way they live in their house, that's an example of somebody who changed out to LEDs, cheap ones that didn't do anything to attempt to circumvent any pitfalls of LED in its just most basic form. And they adjusted to it and didn't really realize what they had lost until they saw something better again. So as far as in commercial, I think obviously light commercial, which is something that's a little more closely to what we do in, say, hospitality, in the form of restaurants, et cetera. It used to be you went to a nice restaurant, and as the evening progressed, they dimmed the lights. And the incandescent lights, as they dimmed, the filament produced less heat, and it was more orange in tone and warmer and had a nice romantic feel, right? Now you go to the restaurant, they do the same thing, and the lights turn grayish green in color as they dim them, and it looks terrible, right? Again, do people not notice that?
Or they flicker. They flicker when they're dimming, too.
Well, they can, yeah. And look, dimmer technology is getting better. Driver technology is getting better. And that's becoming less and less of an issue. Of course, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, flickering in our world, everything is dimming, right, on lighting control systems. It's just about everything. Everything's a nice fade on, fade off. Now we're working with products that have drivers that'll dim down to 0.1% versus, say, down to 20%, flicker at 20% and then shut off, right? So in light commercial, there's obviously a major need for something better. And then I guess in more corporate scenarios, you've got the question of blue light and how it affects people, and you've got people who are businesses or who are now vulnerable to possible lawsuits, I would say, based on exposure to light that might not be healthy for them.
Yeah, flicker is a definite number one concern, I think, from the age of bypassed LEDs where they weren't addressing flicker. There's millions of those in the field. That's not even an argument. We know for sure that hurts people. There's an element of that. Good interior design is good for your health, right? So if you have a beautiful home and you live in it and the lighting is beautiful and it's well designed, you're going to feel better in that space. You're going to like to be in that space more. Natural light is a part of that. The different light fixtures and the different accents and all that sort of stuff you use to do it. So there's that element of it. Then there's an element, I think, which is new. And that is that we have lighting systems that can trick people into thinking it's a window or a skylight. Like that's an entirely different new adaptation in the lighting industry. So if someone didn't know that the producer's office had a fake skylight in it and they went in there, they would think it was a skylight. Like I'm not kidding you. And it does the day long starts off early, goes higher Kelvin temperature, brighter, then goes down again later in the day. The question I have is there actually a physiological element to this other than the one that's created by the perception of it being a window or a skylight? And that's a real physiological perception, but is there something happening with the ice? I haven't seen anything that proves that yet. And, just wondering, Chad, if you've come across that in your career or if you're operating on the same principle that interior design is a good interior design is a healthy design.
Yeah, we're basically selling, or helping our clients achieve an experience. Mm. As far as health benefits, it's something we recommended to a couple years ago, stop talking about and have. However, there is a difference. And one thing we demonstrate to clients is, and we use a product that does sort of a circadian shift to do it. We'll take 3000 Kelvin in a room and we'll dim it down to 10%. And when you take an LED chip that's been tuned to 3000 Kelvin and you push 10% of the light through that phosphorus-based coating, it doesn't produce the same color anymore. The CRI drops incredibly, and the color turns sort of a grayish white, and it looks pretty bad. Mm. And we take that, and then we, at the press of a button, turn that 10% of that same luminaire to 1800 Kelvin and go, now see how this room feels in an evening setting, right? So then we go back to 3000 Kelvin and dim it again down to 10% and varying the ratio of the two color temperatures until we reach 1800 Kelvin at that bottom end. At that point, the customer feels, well, I can really have a space that's very warm and inviting when I want it, when I'm relaxing in the morning or in the evening. So we're selling more of a luxury experience that is mostly lost with LED. Our clients want LED. I think with most of our clientele, if I said, you know what, I really don't recommend LED. We're gonna spec incandescent on your project. I don't think any of them would take well to that. Of course, now there's energy laws, and it depends, you know, county to state to state, county to county, on what you can and can't do. And most counties where I am and surrounding, you can only have but so much of an incandescent quantity of lamps in a home. So, you know, I think LED is here to stay. It's a difficult conversation because it can be because, you know, a client who's built multiple homes, say client's building a home for $5-6 million, right? And they've done it before. And it used to be that a light fixture, they used a housing that was, you know, $150, let's say, and they bought a good quality halogen MR16 for $15. Those days are gone. To get that performance out of at this point in the game, out of a recessed luminaire, you're looking at easily $350.
Yeah, totally.
Multiply that in that house by 180 or 200 fixtures, and it's a substantial difference.
Plus, you're gonna have to install some fussy lighting control system that's gonna be difficult maybe for you to manage, or your wife can't figure it out. How do I turn the lights on in the dining room?
When you show somebody on a keypad the good night button in their bedroom, and you just press that, and all the lights are off in your house, all the questions go away.
Yeah, maybe.
Properly programmed lighting control systems are.
You don't have to sell me. I'm in, buddy. I know what you're talking about, but I think what you're telling us is the best case scenario, Greg.
Let me bring up another, you know, real kind of problem. And it's a problem that a lot of people don't think about. Maybe as people selling fixtures, you hope they don't think about. 10, 15 years, there's going to be some very unhappy customers. For how many years now have we, when a light bulb, whether it be incandescent or LED, where due to a surge or whatever reason, it's failed, doesn't work, and we unscrew it and we put it in a new one? Right. Mm-hmm. When you're buying a higher quality LED luminaire, you're getting something that should be much more reliable than a light bulb that costs $2. Right. However, they will fail. They will shift in color. There isn't a single LED out there where the coating to tune its color won't shift. So as it shifts, the light gets warmer, and typically that coating starts to get cloudy. So they put out less light output, the chip puts out less light output, and that LED light engine is going to fail, right?
Yeah, it's not a joke.
And today, okay.
It's not a joke. How many people does it take to change a light bulb? That's not a joke anymore.
Right. So you buy the Acme recessed lighting fixture that this is a really great product, and in 5 years, one prematurely fails. Okay, you call up Acme and say, hey, listen, my Model AZ7 fixture with a, you know, 40 degree beam angle at 3000 Kelvin has failed and I need a replacement one, and they ship one to you. But what happens in 20 years when Acme Lighting is either out of business or has moved on from making that product, right? And you have one of these fixtures that's failed, right? Well, you're not going to just replace one with someone else's fixture in a home. What about a house that has, you know, wood tongue and groove ceilings? You're now removing the ceiling to replace all the cans, all the housings above the finished ceiling material to replace all the lights. Time will tell.
How many people does it take to change a light bulb? Like, that's not a joke anymore. Yeah, it's not a joke.
Yeah, a demo crew.
Exactly.
An electrician. supplier.
Cody sounds like he wants to start his own podcast. Chad, sorry. I'm reading an email here in front of me. Cody, Chad says you should start your own show. You got a lot of stuff to say, brother. Go ahead, Greg.
Yeah, no, you're right. And that is a topic we talk about a lot, is that they can't be replaced. But what I want to know, bringing it back to history and to kind of close it out, is can lighting be broken down into eras? And if so, like, what's the best era? You know, like, there's the arc light era, there's the incandescent era, there's a fluorescent era, maybe HID era. That's not HID's, you know, specific, but I'm kind of thinking more broader. And then obviously LED.
Halogen.
Are we the best one?
Halogen.
Halogen's incandescent. I'm saying that rolls
together. I think halogen's its own era, man. Constant color MR16s. Yeah.
If you want to talk about historically, culturally, you're looking at the 1920s. Initially, when Edison and his few competitors start selling electric lighting systems on a small scale, you're dealing with a very wealthy consumer or successful business. The electricity, in many cases, the grid didn't exist. So you were putting, behind me is sitting a dynamo from about 1884. You need a steam engine to run that. That has the capacity for 16 candle power lamps, about 50 watts, right? So imagine having to have a dynamo, a boiler to create steam, a steam engine to run the dynamo, and all of this sort of, you know, rigged or experimental still at the point, apparatus, meters, et cetera, to deliver the power. It was very, very inconvenient, and it was only for the very wealthy. And even once central stations started to come about. Now, I have surviving mid-1880s receipts for power where it'll state the number of lamp hours used, right? And for a household. And this one of them is from 1884, and it's about $4. That was a lot of money, right? To have that. And somebody who spent $4 on that month of electricity also would have been supplementing gas lighting with electric lighting. They wouldn't have replaced their entire house. So it was somewhat of a novelty, and then the market was sort of experimenting with it. So it's not until the 1920s that we see, and there were rural areas in the 1950s that were still using localized plants running off of gas engines or things like that. But the 20s is where, in this country and most of Europe, that incandescent lighting became really accessible to all. The lamps weren't expensive. The infrastructure was there, and it really became something that was here to stay, and something that everybody could enjoy. So, as much as an MR16 is far superior than a light bulb from 1922, I think that period of the 1920s culturally is probably the most important.
Bubba, we're gonna electrify the whole state. So I bet you that dynamo, that steam engine, was powered by anthracite coal.
I'm not an expert on
coal.
Like
a furnace? Yeah, for sure. So they had to deliver the coal to you, too. Right. Yeah.
Crazy. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely, yeah.
His name is Chad Shapiro. I called him Cody by accident because my brain is fried.
When your name's Chad, you get all kinds of things. Jack, Dad, Chaz, it's okay.
His website is Sterling, for his practice, is sterlingsv.com. And we're going to go and keep it easy for a bit here, Greg. We're going to go head down to the easy folks at KeystoneTech.com.
To know what to do in lighting, you need to understand history. And Keystone's got history. They've been in lighting a long time. They get it. They know what to do. They do right product, right service, right selection. Make it easy for you. Use Keystone.
Keep it easy. And if you have light bulbs in a warehouse, not a museum, Chad, not a museum, but if you have light bulbs in a warehouse and you sell them over a counter or you sell them on the phone, even if they're cheap, garbagey stuff like Chad was talking about, all that, and you want to learn more, you want to get involved, your association is the National Association of Innovative Lighting Distributors. That's right. We got all sorts of committees, educational committees, accreditation agency committees. We got darkness restoration committees. We got committees coming out our wazoo, so you can get involved. We also have educational programs, and it's just super fun to hang out with Greg and Michael and the rest of the crew down at Nailed. Greg, isn't that right?
That's right. You got to be there.
Got to be there or be square. Go to NALD.org, and if you made it all the way to the end with Chad, Greg, and I, hey, thanks for listening. We appreciate it. That's for sure.